Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Pei Gimel Amud Aleph, at the beginning of the ninth perek, with the Mishnah, Kotev Lishto, person who writes to his wife, Din Udvarim En Li B'Nechasayich, I have no claims against your property. Harzeh Ochel B'Perot B'Chayah, he's entitled to eat the output, the leasehold of that land during her lifetime. V'Meita, and if she passes away, your Shah, he inherits her. So we know that when a woman brings property into the marriage, there are two types of property that she can bring into the marriage. There are Nichsei Tzonu Barzel, and there are Nichsei Melog. With regards to Nichsei Melog, she brings the property in, and the Karen and the physical property remains in the possession of the woman. The husband is entitled to the Peirot, the output of that property, or any leasehold on that property. Then, if the husband dies first, that property remains in the possession of the woman. On the other hand, if the woman predeceases the husband, he inherits that land. So over here, the individual is saying, I have no claim against that land. So as far as his principal rights in the property, which are peirot, and the ability to inherit his wife if she predeceases him, the Mishnah here says that he's still entitled to do both of those items. So then the question is, im kein, lama katav la din udvarim ein li b'nechasayich. If that's the case, then why did he write to her or grant her this right, which says that I have no claims against your property? Shimachra v'natna kayam, to teach you that if she goes ahead and transact in the property, then that transaction holds. In general, he would have a veto right against any transaction that his wife entered into. Over here, the Dinu Dvarim waives that veto right. We'll see later on in the Gemara as to why, out of the three different rights that he has in this property, this is the right that he forfeits when he makes such a statement. Katavla, on the other hand, if he writes her in this language, Dinu Dvarim ein li b'nechasayich u'peirotehem, I have no claims against the property, as well as the output of the peirot that I'm entitled to from these nechsei melog. Harizeh einu achel peirot b'chayah. So now he's also forfeited an additional right, not only the right to veto a sale by her, but also the right to take that output or the peirot during the lifetime of his wife. V'meita, yet the final right that he has in the property, which is that if she predeceases him, he inherits her, your shah, that remains in place, and he inherits her. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, l'olam ochel peirei peirot. So now we have another layer on top of that, which is, you're right that the land or the karen which belongs to the woman in terms of the nifsei malot, it has production, it has output, which are the peirot. But if those peirot are then taken and reinvested, or property is purchased with them, then we have something called peirei peirot, a second derivative of the property. And what Rabbi Yehuda comes to teach us is that when the husband relinquishes his right to the peirot, he only relinquishes his right to the peirot, not to the peirei peirot, the second derivative output of this property. Of course, the question is, if he doesn't have the peirot, how does he get peirei peirot? And the Gemara will deal with that. But how does he then relinquish that right in addition? Achich tovla, until he writes to her, Din udvarim, ein li b'nechasayich, ube peirotehem, ube peirei peirotehem, ad olam. So if he uses the language where he relinquishes all claims on the property, as well as the output from that property, and the second derivative outputs of those properties forever, in that instance, if he does such a thing, then he has relinquished all his rights, both to the peirot, peirei peirot, and we'll discuss later on what happens to third derivative of property. And in addition to that, he has no right of veto if she sells the property. The only remaining right that he has at this point in time is if Imeita, if she predeceases him, Yorsha, he inherits her. Katavla dinu dvarim ein li b'nechasayich ubeperotehem ubeperotehem b'chayayich ubemoteich einu achel perot b'chayaha. Then, again, he's relinquished his rights to take any of the output during her lifetime, because he relinquished his claim to the peirot, the output, the peirei peirot, as well as the derivative outputs, he relinquished control. Dinu dvarim, the fact that he relinquished any claim to the property itself, denies him the right to veto a sale by her. Then the addition of the language, b'chayayich ubemoteich, during your lifetime, and even after you've passed, that adds in the additional relinquishment of his final right, which is, v'meita eino yorsha. If she passes away or predeceases him, he does not have a right to inherit that property. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, imeita yirashena. Shimon Gamliel says, even utilizing that type of language, he would still have the right to inherit her if she predeceases him. Bipnei matne amashakatuv b'torah. because he's making a condition against a Torah law. And anybody who makes a condition against a Torah law, his condition is nullified. It's as if it doesn't exist. And therefore, anything that does not abrogate a Torah law or violate a condition of the Torah will stay in place. From here, it seems that in terms of the Takana of Yerusha, the fact that a husband inherits his wife, that's a din doraita. That's a din min ha-Torah. Since that's min ha-Torah, he doesn't have a right to say, I won't inherit my wife, because then he is making a condition against the Torah law that he inherits his wife. On the other hand, with regards to Perot, as we've seen earlier in the Masechta, that's a Takana derabanan. With regards to a Takana derabanan, there you can create conditions in order to relinquish your claims to those types of Takanot midderabanan. Tani Rabbi Chiya, Ha'omer Liishto. Rabbi Chiya, in his version of this Mishnah, or in terms of his Braita, instead of saying Hakotev Liishto, instead it said Ha'omer Liishto, one who says to his wife. So instead of having, the way our Mishnah indicates, that he wrote and documented this right that he granted to his wife, over here, according to Rabbi Chiya, he simply verbally expressed this relinquishment of his rights to his wife. And the Gemara asks, V'chikatav lo hachi, my havi. What is the difference between Omer and Kotev? Because simply expressing something verbally and then writing it down, the only difference between those two items is simply that you have a documentation of that which was said. But in terms of the force of the kinyan or the transaction here, there's no difference between making a verbal expression and writing something down. Neither of those is a better kinyan than the other. And therefore, the basic question of the Gemara over here is, what does it matter that our Mishnah said a kotev versus ha'omer of Rabbi Chiya? Because if it's sufficient to relinquish these rights through a verbal expression, then writing adds nothing to the dimension over here. Now the Gemara is going to challenge this on both levels, which is, why does either one of these methodologies work? Why does it work in terms of using it verbally, and why does it work in terms of it being written? Therefore, in the end, the difference between Rabbi Chiya and our Mishnah is really not substantive, because it doesn't matter which methodology you use, and we're going to ask a question on both of them. There are Rishonim who suggest that maybe you would have thought that the word Tivan or Mishnah means writing it down with a Kinyan. Therefore, we brought Rabbi Chiya to say how Omer, that his version of the Mishnah said it was a verbal relinquishment of rights, and therefore there was clearly no Kinyan over here. Whether it was written or expressed verbally, there was no Kinyan. If that's the case, how does it work over here, his relinquishments of the rights? V'atanya, don't we have a braita? Omer the chaveiro, someone sends to his friend, he is in a partnership with this individual. Dinu dvarim, en li al sadezu. I have no claims to this field. My portion, my partnership in this field, I have no claims to it. Vein li esek ba. I have no issues with it. V'adi misleket meno. And my hand is removed from it. Lo amar klum. He did absolutely nothing. And that is because he has ownership in this land already. He has ownership in this partnership already. You can't relinquish ownership by simply making a verbal statement that you want to relinquish ownership. If you own something, the only way to convey those rights to another individual is through a kinyan. In the absence of a kinyan, this type of language won't help. And the Gemara's question is, why isn't that the same with our Mishnah? Over here, the husband is entitled to these rights. He has these rights. And since he has these rights, how can he be relinquishing these rights simply by a verbal expression rather than through a formal kinyan? Amrei debei Rabbi Yanai. Debei Rabbi Yanai explains to us, Bekotev la v'oda arusa. It's a case where he writes this to her, and the same would be true in terms of a verbal expression while she is still in arusa. Now, prior to being in arusa, there's no relationship between them. Therefore, his relinquishments of rights would not be meaningful because they don't have any relationship. Now, once they are married, then the rights are his entitlement. He already has them. And therefore, he can't relinquish them, as the Braita tells us, like any other partnership where two individuals have rights to a property. You can't relinquish those rights simply through a verbal expression. And the same would be true with a nisua. Someone who's fully married cannot relinquish their already existing rights. So the Gemara solves the problem through Tana Debei Rabbi Yanai, which suggests that the conversation between them took place while they were arusot, where there is an established relationship, but the husband has yet to have those rights. He doesn't own the rights yet. And what he's saying now is, I will not take those rights when they come to me. I will not accept those rights when they come to me. And now the Gemara explains why that works versus in a case where he already has the rights. Kid Rav Kahana, similar to what Rav Kahana says. Damar Rav Kahana, nachalaha ba'ava adam mimakom acher. If a person inherits property from somewhere else. Now here in somewhere else is as opposed to normal inheritance. This is property that's not coming through the normal channels of Yerusha. And the way Rashi and seemingly Tosfot explain this, that means that it's not Yerusha d'oraita. It's only Yerusha d'rabbanan. And since it's only Yerusha d'rabbanan, therefore these methodologies work over here. That's one way to explain it. That's the way Rashi and Tosafot explain it. On the other hand, there is another cadre of Rishonim led by the Ramban who suggests that the difference is not between Yerusha d'oraita and Yerusha d'rabbanan. It can even be that Yerusha from Makom Acher is a Yerusha d'oraita. The difference being whether there is absolute certainty about the Yerusha. When you're talking about blood Yerusha, in that case, the individual, when they're born, is entitled to the Yerusha. There's nothing that will change that relationship between the parent and the child that the child would not be Yoresh. Again, of course, unless the child passes away, but then there's no issue in terms of Yerusha then. As long as this child is still alive, they're entitled to that Yerusha from the day that they're born. On the other hand, when you talk about Yerusha that comes through marriage, there are plenty of sfeikot. There are plenty of unknowns that could take place where the Yerusha would not definitively come to this individual. So because of that, the Ramban says the distinction here is between Yerusha, which is absolute and certain, versus Yerusha that comes out of a certain amount of uncertainty. And therefore, when the person gets this, they can make such a declaration. When it comes to Makocher, Adam Matne'ala, Shlo Yerashena. Person can make a declaration that he will not inherit it. Again, according to Rashi and Tosafot, that's simply because it's a din d'rabbanan. Since it's a din d'rabbanan, he can create a condition which prevents him from inheriting the property that is coming to him. On the other hand, in terms of the Ramban's shita, it means that I can make a condition here not to inherit something that is not certainly coming my way. And I can say I can relinquish my rights over here. Ucha de Rava, and similar to what Rava says, the Amar Rava. Rava says, Homer e efshi betakanat chachamim gonzo, shomim lo. If a person says that I decline this benefit that the chachamim have offered me, like this, and the Gemara asks what that like is, then the person has a right to do that. It's the equivalent of declining a penalty in football where the penalty will not advantage you as much as whatever you've accomplished already. So a person can decline something that is coming to him and is in his favor if it doesn't do what he wants it to do. Micah Gonzu, what's an example of this? Ravuna Merav, like we've seen earlier in the Masechta, Damar Ravuna Merav, Yechola Isha Shetehamer the Bala, a woman can say to her husband, Eini Nizonet, I don't want you to feed me or sustain me or take care of me, Ve'eini Osa, and I prefer not to have to give you my Masei Yadayim, either because she doesn't intend on working, and she doesn't want to have that be the exchange, or from the other perspective, that her Masei Yadayim far exceed the value of her mizonot, and therefore she wants to maintain her Masei Yadayim. The Takarat Chachamim was in her favor. They were afraid that there were times that a woman would not produce sufficiently to sustain herself, and therefore they granted her the right to mizonot for Masei Yadayim, even though there was no value equivalency. So the woman, when it's a case where that does not favor her, because for instance, her Masei Yadayim are worth more than the mizonot, she can decline such a takana d'rabbanan. So in this case, also, according to Rashi and Tosafot, the ability over here, similar to what happens by mizonot, is you have a din d'rabbanan that is supposedly put in place to benefit me. If it doesn't come, or I choose not to engage that din d'rabbanan, that's my choice. So just like by the mizonot, the woman can say, no thank you to the mizonot, I'll keep my Masei Yadayim. The husband can say the same thing. No thank you to that Yerusha that was granted to him by the Rabbanan. And he'll say, I don't want it. And if he says, I don't want it, it doesn't come through. On the other hand, according to the Ramban, who says that there is uncertainty over here, that uncertainty is what grants him the right to relinquish the gift that is coming his way. Similar to the woman by the Mizonot, which is, these Lishonot of Siluk are no good once you have rights or ownership in the property. Because you cannot relinquish control or rights once you already have them, Ella, except through a kinyan. On the other hand, when it comes to something that has yet to reach your possession, what you can do is use these languages to say, I don't want it to come into my possession. And similar to the Masi Adam and the Mizonot, the woman over there takes a stand where she says, I don't want this right to come into my possession. Since it's prior to the right being engaged, I have such an ability to relinquish my ability to claim that right. And so too with regards to Yerusha. Before property enters into my possession, I can say, I don't want it. I'm not interested in it. Even though I have a right to it, I'm not interested in it. And that language will be sufficient to stop it from actually coming into my possession. This language will have no significance once it's in my possession, but to prevent it from coming into my possession, that works. Over here, Tosafot tries to discuss what does Rova's statement add that wasn't already true through Rav Kahana. Rav Kahana already told us that a person could make such a condition prior to the Yerusha coming to him. And both for the Rashi and Tosafot and for the Ramban, from that we know that the ability to reject the Yerusha is either because it's a din d'rabbanan or for the Ramban because it has yet to enter into my possession. And that's sufficient. What did Rova add by bringing in this example that by the Mizonot, which says that you can reject a Takanat Chachamim? And therefore, Tosfot explains that if we only had the din of Rova, we wouldn't have learned that you can make such a condition or siluk in something davash lo bali olam, for something that has yet to come into the world. In the case of relinquishing or rejecting the Yerusha that's come to you, it has yet to come to you. And since it has yet to come to you, it's a davash lo bali olam. It's something that doesn't exist yet. So what Rav Kahana teaches us is you can invoke this ability to reject something even where it has yet to come to you, davash lo bali olam. With regards to Rava, that's not the case. Because even though Rava's statement is speaking about Rav Huna, about Mizonot, which are also something that Shalom Bali Olam, Tosva points out, by Mizonot, that is something that is given to her and you're going to force her to eat or take the Mizonot. Can't force somebody to take it. So therefore, when she relinquishes that right, it's not really a Davar Shalom Bali Olam. We simply can't force her. She won't be sustained out of the Mizonot if she so chooses. On the other hand, when it comes to ownership of property, over there, it could be that the person owns it even without his acquiescence. And that's the Chiddush of Rav Kahana over here, that even at the Vashlo B'Alam, he has a right to relinquish that future control that would come into his possession. On the other hand, if we just had Rav Kahana and we didn't have Rova, we would have thought that this is only according to the view that says you can be Makneh the Vashlo B'Alam. What Rova comes along to reinforce and said is, that even if it's a davar shalom b'al olam, a person has a right, because it's a takanat chachamim l'tovato, he has a right to relinquish that right, even though it's a davar shalom b'al olam. So therefore, according to Tosafot, Rav Kahana and Rova reinforce each other on these points. Number one is that you can interact with a davar shalom b'al olam, that this works even according to the one who says that you cannot interact with davar shalom b'al olam. The combination of Rav Kahana and Rova together say that even if you hold that way, in this instance, we will give you such a right to relinquish control because it has yet to come into your possession. And the whole takana was l'tovatcha. The whole takana here was to your benefit. And since it was to your benefit, you can opt out or decline that right that was granted to you by the Chachamim. Whereas according to the Ramban, you might have learned from Rav Kahana that this din was only applicable in dinim deoraita. But by Dine de Rabbanan, as we'll see later on in this sugya, the possibility is that the Rabbanan made their din so powerful that you weren't able to do such a thing. Along comes Rabba to say that the same vehicle exists even in Dine de Rabbanan. Just like by Dine de Oraita, one can relinquish something that has yet to come into their possession. So too, by Takanat Chachamim, one can interact in that same manner. And it applies both to things that are on a level de Oraita, as well as things that are on a level de Rabbanan. Mar says, if that's the case, why can't we say the same thing when they are already married? Why is this ability to relinquish the rights only true when they are arusot? Why can't that also be true when they are nisuot? So Amar Abaye, nisua, because when it comes to nisua, yado ki yada. Abaye says that the husband's rights inside of his wife's property are on equal footing with his wife. They are on the same level. Rova Amar, yado adifa mi yada. Now then, Rova says that he actually has stronger rights on the property than his wife. Now the truth is, this has no bearing in terms of our sugya according to Rashi, because whether he has equal rights to his wife, or he has stronger rights to his wife, he then becomes like any partnership or any partner in the property, If that's the case, we saw before that these languages of relinquishment are not sufficient to allow him to relinquish the rights and to stop the property from being in his possession. And therefore, whether according to Rava or according to Abaye, there is no way that he can use these languages and have it be effective in relinquishing his rights. But then the Gemara asks, nafkamino, that the difference between a Rava and Abaye is not relevant in our sugya, but rather it's a nafkamino l'shomeret yavam. It has to do with someone who is waiting for the yavam to perform yibum with the woman. Goes back to a sugya that we have, a very complex sugya that we saw back in Yivamot, which discusses the situation in which property falls to a woman who is a shomeret yavam, and then she passes away. In that case, what is the rights of the yavam to that property? And Abaye suggests over here that the property actually fell to the original husband while they were still married. And then over here, now, once he has passed away, Abaye says that the rights of the husband and the woman were equal in those properties. And therefore, once he dies or passes away, and it becomes before the yavam, and she dies, there is an equal footing over here. And therefore, the Yorshei Baal and the Yorshei Av will split this property. On the other hand, Rova disagrees with Rabbi and says that if the property fell to her while she was married to her first husband, then there's no question that the husband has stronger rights than her in the property. And therefore, when he passes away, the Yorshim of that property are his brothers, the Avam or his brothers, and the Yorshei Av have nothing or no rights in this property. So therefore, Rova sets up the question as a question of Machloket with regards to property that fell to her while she was a Shomeret Yavam, while she was awaiting Yibum. In that case, the husband's rights already been diffused because he passed away. The Yavam has yet to perform Yibum with her. So in that case, Rova believes that if they were really married, he would have much stronger rights than the woman in the property. But when she's a Shomeret Yavam, then the Yavam and this Yavama have equal rights. And therefore, it's a safek that lands you with the Yorshei Av and the Yorshei Baal arguing or splitting the property between them. Others suggest that it actually has enough nafkamina to our sugya in a case where the Yavam writes to the Yavama dinu dvarim. He uses the language that is found in our Mishnah to relinquish his rights with regards to his Yavama. The question then is, what's the status of the Yavama? Is the Yavama deemed to be a arusa, or is she deemed to be a nisua? And that will depend on this machlok between Abaye and Rova, what the level of relationship there is between the Yavama and the Yavam. And that will have influence on whether he has the ability to relinquish the rights. If he's like an Arusa, that's what Abaye would be saying, then he can relinquish those rights. If he's deemed to be a Nisua, which would be the position of Rova, then he wouldn't have rights to relinquish this when he is a Yavam dealing with his Yavama before they have consummated the Yibum. The Gemara asks now a question. Kanomi Ado Mahu. If he actually makes a formal kinyan over here, then what happens? Now, in terms of the Mishnah, Rashi says this is no longer a relevant question because our Mishnah already says that this happened Ba'od Arusa. This all happened when she was in Arusa. And in that case, the kinyan is no different than the language of relinquishment. We say that the language of relinquishment is sufficient and effective when she is in Arusa. So then kinyan would not add anything over here. So the question of the Gemara here is with regards to the Braita that we brought before, the Braita that it says that when a person uses these languages, when he's already a partner in a field, none of this language works. The question then is, if he makes a formalized kinyan with these languages, does it work? That's the question of the Gemara according to Rashi. On the other hand, Tosafot suggests that that's not the question of the Gemara, but rather the question of the Gemara is by a nisua. In a case of nisua where this language of relinquishment doesn't work, then making a kinyan, is a kinyan effective in these cases? That is because he has an issue with Rashi's explanation, which is, if what kinyan are we speaking about here? In the case of the Braita, all he's doing is relinquishing control of his property. He's not granting that right to some other party. A kinyan needs two sides. Over there, he's just giving it out in general. And therefore, kinyan is not even a relevant topic over there. And therefore, Tosafot would suggest it has to do with the case of nisua over here, where if the individual relinquishes his rights while he is a nisua, and he does that through a kinyan, is that effective using these languages to grant those rights back to his wife? Whereas the Tosafot read, quotes from Rav Haigon and the Reed Zatzal, that it's going back on the bright dog that said, "Bekotev di shtovo da rusa." It's going back on the fact that he wrote this to his wife while she's still in Arusa. When he does a kinyan here, is the kinyan just a reinforcement of the language that he used? Or is the kinyan actually changing the dynamic here and actually making a stronger interaction between them where he's relinquishing his complete rights here, only reinforcing what he said in our Mishnah of Kotev? He wrote Dinin Devarim, Nechsayef, Peirot, whatever he said, the kinyan just reinforces that but doesn't add anything on top of that. And that's the question here. The Tosafot read also quotes the shot of the Tosafot from Rav Tzemach Gaon and Rav Nachshon Gaon. And in the end, he says that's okay, but he still favors Rashi's interpretation of the Gemara. So now the Gemara says, "Nachan Amar, Amar Rav Yosef, Midinu Dvarim Kanu Miyado." Rav Yosef says that Midinu Dvarim is just a reinforcement of the existing statement, and therefore it does nothing. Just like the language, according to Rashi in the Braita, does nothing. So too, the Kinyan, just later on top of that, is just a reinforcement of language that does absolutely nothing. According to Rav Haigon, that's a risk of reinforcement in the Mishnah. If he does this when an Udarusan, he does a Kinyan on top of it, it just reinforces whatever rights he relinquished, depending on the language he used in the Mishnah, the Kinyan just reinforces that, does not change that dynamic whatsoever. And according to Tosafot, it's no better than Din Udvarim, and therefore it doesn't work when he's in Nisua. On the other hand, Rav Nachman Amar, Migufa Shokarka Kanam Yodo. On the other hand, Rav Nachman believes that this Kinyan is more effective. It actually is directed at the land itself, and not simply the statement that he made before. Therefore, according to Rashi, the Kinyan would be effective over here if he's trying to relinquish his rights in the property, even though the language that he used would not be sufficient in itself. Or, according to Tosafot, when he's in Nisua, he could relinquish his rights to his wife in such a manner through a Kinyan, even though the language of Dinat Varim would not work. And according to Rav Hagon, in the Mishnah, only when he uses this language alone is he relinquishing specific rights. But if he uses a kinyan, then he's relinquishing his entire control over the property. Amar Abaye, Mistavra Milta de Rav Yosef, Abaye, the Talmud of Yosef says that Rav Yosef's statement makes sense, Be'orer. In a case where he immediately says, that's not what I meant to do, that's not the case here. I'm not granting you rights here, I'm not relinquishing my rights over here. Avo bo'omeid, migufashto karkak hano miyado. On the other hand, if he waits a couple of days, and then comes back and says, you know what, I didn't really mean it, I used this bad language, which is the Din Dvarim, as Tosafot calls it, Lashon Grua, a language that has no effectiveness, and therefore the Kinyan was just sitting on top of that language and it meant nothing. Over there, we do not believe him. And Rashi says that's because he went to see his lawyers, and he wants to renege on the gift that he granted or the rights that he relinquished. And now they advise him to say this. But if he does it immediately and it makes it clear that he has no intent that this Kinyan is any better than the language that he used, then in that case, we believe him because he was just reinforcing the language. Now then, if he does it after a period of time, we say no, the Kinyan was an effective Kinyan, and someone is trying to teach him now to distinguish between a Kinyan without this language and a Kinyan with this language. Never the locha should be like Rav Nachman, even according to Rav Yosef in that instance. Therefore, if he objects when the other individual comes to claim his rights or take the property and he objects right away, then we believe him. On the other hand, if he, after a couple of days of this person taking control over the property and comes and then says it, then we don't believe him and we believe that his kinyan was intended for the core of the property. Amar Meimar, Meir says, Ilkodat migufasho kakakanam yodo. The halacha is like Rav Nachman over here, that there is a real kinyan that is affected over here, according to Rashi. That means that it overcomes the deficit in the language that's used. According to Tosafot, that means it can even work when he's a Nisua. And according to the Rav Haigon, it means that in our Mishnah, if he uses that language, it does a Kinyan. The Kinyan relinquishes all his rights and is not limited by the language that he uses. Amale Rav Ashi Lameimar, Be'orer, O Be'omeid. Rav Ashi said to Ameimar, you didn't define for us when that is the case. We already saw that Abaye differentiated between whether he raises questions about this issue right away versus at a later date. When you say the halacha is, that's Mugufa Shokarka, is that only if he immediately says, no, I didn't intend for this when he comes to claim the property? Or is it even if he raises the issue after a period of time? So when it says, the my nafkamina, the Rav Yosef, the nafkamina is in Rav Yosef's shita as to whether it's on Guf Shokarka or versus just a reinforcement of the language that he used. Amalei lo shmieli, says, I didn't hear about this. Kolmar lo svirli, I don't hold of that position, that distinction or differentiation within the position of Yosef. I don't think the halacha is like Rav Nachman, and therefore it doesn't matter when the ir-ur was raised. irrespective of what the guy says afterwards, he was talking about Gruva Shokarka, and the Locha is like Rav Nachman, not a modified or qualified Rav Yosef. So Gemara says, Imkein Lama Katav Lo. So the Mishnah says that the husband has three different rights in the property. He has a veto right if she sells it. He has a right to the output, the payroll of the property. And he has a right to inherit her if she predeceases him. So therefore, when he says, Dinu Dvarim, he uses that language that I have no claims against your property. We said that he only relinquished the right to veto if she sells it. Why doesn't he just say to him, listen, you relinquished all your rights. And it applies to all three different rights. And Rabbi says the reason is, Yad Balashtar Alatachtona. When we have ambiguous language inside of a document that records a transaction, then the one who's making the claim over here has the lowest rights. We're going to say that if there was this ambiguous language and there are different ways to interpret the language, we're going to say that we're going to give you the least amount here because you're the one who has to prove that there was more granted to you. So same thing over here. The husband said, I have no rights to the property. So that can be interpreted in many different ways. The least way to interpret it, meaning giving up the least amount, is by simply saying that he relinquished his veto right on her sales of the property. So the Gemara says, if that's the case, vehemami peret. How do you know which of the three items he relinquished his rights to? Why did you suggest that it's that he gives up his veto right? Maybe he gave up the peret. Amar Rabaye botzina tav mikra. So the way Rashi interprets it is that a small gourd is better than a big gourd. If an individual offers someone to go into the field now and pick a nice gourd in the field, or listen what, you can come back in 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and when it grows even bigger, you can take it. The person will opt to take the gourd that exists there right now and have something in hand. Basically, the common expression of bird in hand is better than two in the bush. And therefore, over here as well, he would rather take what's right in front of him than wait the extra 3 weeks to see if it grows bigger and then take it then. Tosafot actually says that it's two different species. One of them is a zucchini versus a gourd, and the zucchini's ripen faster. So he offers him to go in the field and pick a zucchini now, or he offers him the ability to wait and pick a gourd, which will be much bigger later. And again, he opts for the zucchini now. So just a nuance in the expression, but it means the same thing, which is a bird in hand is better than two in the bush. And therefore, a person would never relinquish their rights to the payroll versus their right to veto a sale, which might or might not happen. Beimam Yerusha. So why don't we say that he relinquishes his right to inherit the property and he keeps his veto right against the sale? So Amar Abaye, Abaye says, Mito Shchicha, Mechira Lo Shchicha. When it comes to death, death is more common than Mechira, than a sale. The way that Tosafot expresses this is, Shema Mishum Derov Pe'amim, Mista Kenet Veleida. So what he's saying over here is that Mito Shchicha is a specific reference to the woman. Women will most times predecease their husbands. And therefore, because of that, there's a higher likelihood that he'll inherit this property because his wife predeceases him than his wife actually selling the property. And that's because the actuarial lifespan of women in those days was very short because of the risks of childbirth. On the other hand, there are others that explain here that Mita Shchicha, Mechira Lo Shchicha is not about the relative actuarial lives of the husband and the wife, where the husband thinks he's going to outlive his wife, but rather an absolute statement that the likelihood of death, which is certain, everybody dies at some point, versus Mechira, is much more Shchiach. And that is because a woman is reluctant to sell the property that belonged to her father's house, at Shevach Beit Aviah, and the likelihood that she would actually sell something is very low. So his need to exercise the veto right will be almost nil, versus the possibility of him inheriting the wife, where that's a much higher likelihood she will at some point pass away. Yes, there's uncertainty. He might pass away first, but that's still something that's more likely to happen, that he'll inherit his wife, than the fact that his wife will go sell the property and he'll need to veto such a sale. And therefore, our understanding here with an ambiguous statement is that a person, when he relinquishes rights, will relinquish the most unlikely right that he will have to exercise, which is the veto over here. Mamilta de Shchicha is something that is very plausible that he will inherit his wife. Lo Masalik Inche Nafshe, an individual will not, at that point, give up his rights. So again, because the language is not clear, we're going to say out of all these three rights, the least likely to happen is what he relinquished over here. And the least likely to happen or be meaningful to him over here is his veto right over the sale. And that's what he relinquished to his wife. But he retained his rights to eat the payroll, and he retained his rights to inherit his wife. Rav Ashi Amar, Benifsayich velo achar mita. Vashi on the other says that it's not because yad balashtar la tachtona, and that's what seemingly Tosfot says over here, which is that Ravashi does not subscribe to this principle, which is that when we have an ambiguous statement or a statement of relinquishment, we look at the lowest possibility of what he would give up, and that would be the discerning factor. The other hand, Ravashi says it has nothing to do with that. It simply has to do with the diyuk min alashon, that if you look at what he relinquished nechsayich, your possessions, and he's medayik from that, that means nechsayich, your possessions, but not your payroll. I want those payroll. Nechsayich, and your property, and not achar mitah, not after death, or the ability to be yoresh this property. And Tosafot takes it for granted that Ravashi is rejecting by his previous answer, which is yad balashtar tachtona, and therefore he asks on Ravashi, why is she only allowed to then sell the property bidyavad? She should actually be able to sell it the chatchila. She should be able to transact because he's relinquished such a right. But as many of the other Rishonim say that Ravashi does subscribe to what Abayi says of yad balashtar tachtona, he just doesn't think it's relevant over here. Because when do we say yad balashtar tachtona? That's when a person is trying to extract property from another party. So they come with the shtar trying to extract the property where the other individual has the chazaka on the property. Then we say that your rights are minimized by the ambiguity of the contract. On the other hand, over here, the woman herself is the one who holds all the rights and the property over here. She's coming to say, well, the husband relinquished his rights over here. He's not the one who's mukzak in the property. The wife is mukzak in the property. Therefore, yad balashtar al-tachtona is less meaningful in this case because she already has the property and it's a question of relinquishment of rights. In that case, Ravashi says that the better principle to invoke over here is the diuk from the Lashon rather than saying, yad balashtar latachtona. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, lolam hu ochel peirei peirot. So Rabbi Yehuda says that he has the rights to the derivatives of the peirot as long as he doesn't say peirei peirot ad olam. Now, Tanu Rabbanan, Elohen Peirot, Velohen Peirei Peirot. When Rabbi Yehuda says that, what's the difference between Peirot, which are the output, the leasehold in the land, versus Peirei Peirot, the derivatives of that? So, Ichnisolo Karka, she brings in property, Vasta Peirot, and it produces output or Peirot, Harien Peirot. That's the definition of Peirot. Machar Peirot, if they sell those Peirot, Velakach Mehen Karka, and through the sale of those Peirot, they then purchase land, Vasta Peirot, and that new land then produces Peirot. Harihen Peirei Peirot. That's the derivative of Peirot. That's second derivative Peirot. So now, Ibayilu, the Gemara asks, Le Rabbi Yehuda. According to Rabbi Yehuda, Peirei Peirot Davka, Odil Ma'ad Olam Davka. When Rabbi Yehuda says that the only language that helps here for him to relinquish all rights to any Peirot, or a Peirei Peirot, and so on and so forth, that's only when he uses the term Peirei Peirot, and Ad Olam is not so important. Or is it the other way around? The Peirei Peirot is not so important, but the Ad Olam is important. Or you need both languages over here. It's Peirei Peirot Ad Olam. Together, they are what paint such a relinquishment of the husband on any derivatives of the Peirot. So Mara says, Imtim Solomar Peirei Peirot Davka. If you want to suggest that the Peirei Peirot is what you need here, Ad Olam, Lomali. What do I need Ad Olam for? Hakamashvalon. Well, it teaches me, Kevan Dichtavla Peirei Peirot, Kiman Dichtavla Ad Olam Dami. It comes to teach you that Peirei Peirot is the equivalent of Ad Olam. So it writes Ad Olam not because that is necessary for the language to work over here, but rather to teach you that lesson that Peirei Peirot is the equivalent of Ad Olam. Beitim Salom Ad Olam Dafka, that Ad Olam is the more important language over here. Peirei Peirot Lomali. Why do I need the words Peirei Peirot in there? Hakamashmalan. Dahva Gav Dichtavla Peirei Peirot. That comes to teach you that even if he writes Peirei Peirot, Ikad of Ad Olam in Ilolo. Peirei Peirot by itself would not be sufficient. It's the Ad Olam that makes all the difference over here. Vimtim Salamar Tarvayu Davka. You say that you need both languages over here. Tarte Lamali. Why do I need two languages to teach me that he's relinquishing all rights and all derivative rights in the Peirot? Tzricha, I do need both. Dikad of La Peirei Peirot, Velokad of La Ad Olam. Had he only written Peirei Peirot and not Ad Olam, Havamina Peirei Peirot, who Dolo Achil? I would have thought that only second derivative Peirot he relinquished his rights to. Aval Peirei, the Peirei Peirot, third derivative Peirot, Achil, he would have rights to. Achil Yitzrich, Ad Olam. Ad Olam comes to teach you, etc. Peirei Peirot is not the end of the line. It means Peirot, Peirei Peirot, and anything that comes after that. Bikat of Ad Olam, had you just wrote Peirot and Ad Olam, Velokat of La Peirei Peirot, and he had not used the language of Peirot, Havamin, I would have thought, the Olam a Peirot Kai. It's coming to teach you that forever the perot I relinquish my rights to. And that's why I need perot. So Rashi suggests over here that had he only relinquished perot ad olam, it would have meant that all through our marriage, I will not take perot. But had he not wrote the word olam, we would have thought maybe only in the first year he relinquishes his rights to perot. But in the second and third year, he would be entitled to perot. Tosafot takes issue with that and says, why would anybody think that? Once you relinquish rights to perot, it means for the lifetime of this right. And that means throughout the marriage. And therefore, Tosafot suggests over here that the Havamina would have been that olam perot, shebechayah umota lo yochal perot. Adolam would mean that both in her lifetime and even after her death, he will not get those rights to the perot. So that's what you would have thought olam. Olam means not just during her lifetime, but even after her passing, he would not have rights to those perot. And that's what adolam would mean. Therefore, I enter in perot to say to you that the olam is not modifying the duration of the perot, but rather perot derivatives and multiple derivatives of the perot. In defense of Rashi, many suggest that the person could relinquish their right in the first year. For instance, and say, look, I love you so much. In the first year, I want you to keep the perot as a gift from me. But after that, I don't. And that's what the Adolam comes to say. No, I'm granting you that right forever. And therefore, what Rashi says makes some sense. Now, Ibaylu katavla din udvarim enli binechasayich ubepere perot mahu shiochal perot. The individual comes along and says, I have no claims against your property and the derivative of the perot. What's the din in terms of perot? He only relinquished his right, seemingly in terms of his veto right to sell the property. That's din and dvarim. He also relinquished his rights with regards to peret perot, derivatives of perot, but perot themselves he did not address. Mi peret perot salik nafshei. Did he only relinquish his rights to derivative perot? Mi peret lo salik nafshei. But from perot themselves he did not relinquish his rights. But when he says peret perot, included in derivatives of perot is the perot themselves. Mar says, pshitad b'kol milei salik nafshei. It's very clear that he relinquished all rights here, both to perot and all derivative perot. Diamart mi peret perot salik nafshei. Because if you suggest that he only relinquished his rights to derivative perot, mi peret lo salik nafshei, but when it comes to perot themselves, he did not relinquish his rights. Kevin da achilno the perot, since he eats the perot, peret perot mehecha. If he already eats all the perot, he takes all of that for himself, then how is there any derivative of the perot? He's already taking possession of the perot. There are no peret perot to speak of. So if he says, I have rights to perot and not peret perot, it will never come to be meaningful because he already took everything in the value of the perot. Marseh ulitameich, according to your reasoning, hadatanan, that which is said in our Mishnah, Yudo Mer, lo'olam hu ochel peret perot, that he's allowed to eat derivatives of the perot, but not perot. Kevin achlino the peret, since she has the rights to the perot, peret perot meicha, then where are their derivative perot that Rabbi Yehuda is saying, you know, he only gave up his rights to the perot. He didn't give up his rights to the derivatives of the perot. What do you mean? Once he gives up his rights to the perot, there are no peret perot to speak of. Ella de Bishariya must be a case where there's leftovers. She took the perot, but some of those perot were left over. What do we do with those leftover perot? We purchase land on her behalf. And that land then becomes something that will produce derivative perot. The same thing will be true over here. In a case where he gets the rights to the perot, if there are leftover perot which he did not utilize or didn't do something with it, those excess, we will buy land with them. And when we buy the land, then there will be peret perot, derivatives of the perot that he will not be entitled to. And therefore, you can't prove anything from here as to whether when he says peret perot, he means dafka peret perot and not perot, or does he mean peret perot inclusive of perot? Okay, we'll stop over here by the two dots in the bottom of Pei Gimel Amud Bet.